Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 16th, 1998. And in the fireside room this morning, the presenter will be Gene Olson, and the session will be called Being Comfortable in the Uncomfortable, Befriending the Sick, the Lonely, and the Elderly. This is tape number OLJ98-1.
My name is Jeannie Olson, and the name of this class is Being Comfortable with the Uncomfortable, Befriending the Sick, the Lonely, and the Elderly. And I'm glad you're here. When I was looking at the theme for this summer, and I saw that it was practicing our faith and guiding our feet, I decided that this class would be appropriate because I really do believe that one of the ways that we practice our faith, as in the book that Dorothy Bass edited, is by hospitality and healing. Then those are two of the chapters in their book. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we practice that by hospitality is by being present to each other. And listening to the sacred stories that we all have that make up part of who we are and what we're going through as people. And I truly do believe that in the telling of stories that there is healing. And that's what this session will be all about. Hearing stories and knowing how to respond to them, not just in a caring way, but in a sensitive way. Because I think we all are caring, but sometimes, and I will be sharing three stories with you right here at the beginning here, we aren't always as sensitive as we wish we were. I'm a chaplain in a hospital, and the hospital used to be a Catholic hospital, and the nuns ran it. And in every room they had a Roman crucifix. But when they built the new building, they got rid of the crucifixes, and they bought what they told me were Lutheran crosses. And it's a cross, and Jesus is on the cross, but it's a victorious, resurrected Christ. It's a really, really neat thing. Well, somebody brought in one because it had fallen off the wall and the hands had gotten broken off. So there was this Christ, but the hands were broken. And they started to do something with it to get rid of it. And I said, no, I want that one. They said, why do you want this one? It's broken. I said, because the hands are gone. And that's my theology. And so I hung it on my door. So when I leave my office, that's the last thing I see. Because it reminds me that I become the hands of Christ to those people. Hopefully that I will be visiting in the hospital, that are patients, the staff that are working in the hospital who have very difficult jobs, who are also the hands of Christ, and who anybody else, families, friends who walk into the hospital. We as chaplains believe that we minister not only to the patients, but to their families and to the staff and anybody else we come in contact with. I also believe that we do ministry in the grocery store. I mean, how many times have you been standing in the grocery store kind of waiting because this line is going so slow, and the lady in front of you or the man turns around and starts talking to you, and all of a sudden you find out, you know, that, you know, such and such just happened in their life, and they're kind of pouring out the stores, and there you are standing in the grocery store. So we become those ears of Christ and hands of Christ in a variety of places. The first thing I'm going to do is tell you some stories of some people who came caring to various situations, but weren't as sensitive as I think they could have been. The first story, and these are all true stories, and I know all the people who participated in, unfortunately. I want to ask you a question first. How many of you in the last week, 2 weeks, whatever, have had someone share a story with you about their lives, whether about their kids or their faith or their problems or, you know, the journey that they've been on, whatever. Raise your hand if somebody shared with you a significant life story. Okay, I think that's just about everybody. So we find ourselves in these situations all the time. The first story is of a woman who was widowed some years ago, was visiting a woman who was just recently widowed, like 4 weeks before. And she had made a call, this is a very definite call. She was called, can I come over and visit you, sort of thing. Not long into the conversation, the woman who was doing the calling said, and I'm making up names, "You know, you're not Mrs. John Smith anymore."
Oh,
and the woman
no.
said, "What do you mean, I'm not?" And she said, "Well, your status has changed, and your identity has changed, and you're not Mrs. John Smith anymore, and you're going to have to get used to that." And the other woman said, who was a spunky, wonderful lady, said, "Well, I've always been Mary Smith, and I'll be Mary Smith, you know, until I die." And it was extremely offended for the rest of the visit, I might add, with this person. Now, I know the lady who made the visit, and she did come caring. But as you can see, and by the reaction, I love the reaction you gave, totally insensitive. The problem was, she came with her own agenda. I'm going to help this lady get through this and push her through and tell her all the pitfalls and tell her what's going to happen. It's all wrong. You know, it's wrong in the situation. The second story is of a hospital caller, and I hate to say that he went through our training for 28 weeks. I am glad to say that I was not the trainer at the time. Our callers are given a floor, a particular floor. The list of the patients are there. They go up and make cold calls, which means they don't know these people, on people in the hospital. He went up, it was a cancer floor. He introduced himself to the person, sat down, and he said to her, "What brings you to the hospital?" And I want you to listen very carefully to the verbs in this. "Oh, I had cancer, but I just had a mastectomy." Now, before the patient could even continue with her story, he said to her, "That's just what my wife died of." Needless to say, we got a call from her nurse not long after that and needed to go up and do some patching up of a terrible mistake. And I'm relieved to say that this gentleman is no longer making visits, and the unfortunate thing is he never learned to be sensitive and to kind of say the right thing. Though I know him to be a caring person. The last story is, I was a chaplain for Candlelighters, which is a support group for parents whose children have cancer.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, one of our 14-year-old girls had died of cancer, and I had gone to the visitation, and I was standing in the line at this visitation. And the mother of the child and her brother, younger brother, were standing in the line as I was progressing through. And the woman in front of me, who must have been a family friend, said this. Nancy was the child's name. "Nancy was the sweetest child ever. She was the very best. No child could compare with her. And you know, God only takes the best." And he must have needed another little angel in heaven. Now I want you to think about what was said from the perspective of the little brother, who was about 10. Nancy must have been the best. This lady said so. So where does that put him? Mm-hmm. Not any better than at least second best, right? Consciously or unconsciously, what is this kid thinking? God takes the best. He didn't take me. I saw what happened to my sister. I'm going to make sure that I'm not the best. Can you imagine what kind of little hellion this kid could become? If God does that and you get to be so good and then he snatches you away, good grief. You know, and let's say the scenario unfolds that this kid does become that. Nobody knows why, but this conversation embedded in his little new theology that doesn't know how to cope with this, and he becomes that. And then, of course, she adds her own theological perspective of why people die, because God needed another little angel in heaven. I teach a class on angels, and there's a tape in the library about that, and one of the things I talk about is I don't happen to believe, which is my own personal theology, in God plucking children out of the arms of their parents so that he could add to his angel collection. That doesn't go with my theology. Attempted in her own caring way to be comforting. But if there's something that I will repeat several times this morning, it will be, don't use cliches. They seem to never work, and the worst ones seem to hover around grief, funerals, visitations. Yeah. You're going to agree, aren't you? You're nodding your head. Yes. The absolute, and if we share our theology, which isn't the theology of the person that we're sharing them with, the conversation sort of ends. But we will talk about that later. So we want to kind of hone in on those sensitivity skills. And one of the things I'm going to have you do, and unfortunately you're kind of trapped here because you've already committed to coming to this class, you're going to have to do something with me. But some of you are going to like doing, some of you are going, oh, I hate to do that. But bear with me for 5 minutes. And that is, I'm going to ask you to close your eyes for about 5 minutes, maybe less. And I'm going to walk you through an imagination sort of thing, imaging sort of thing. You're going to have to look at yourself as old. You're going to have to look at yourself with a chronic illness. You're going to have to look at yourself in a living situation that you aren't in now. Thinking about someone who is a loved one of yours that has recently died. And then a visitor is going to come and visit you, whether you know this person or not, we'll kind of determine. And you're going to have a conversation with this visitor. And then you're going to react on how you felt about that visit. And this little exercise that we're going to do is kind of a jumping off place of talking about what was helpful to you, what wasn't helpful to you, and so on. So if you're willing to do this with me, I'd like you to close your eyes, get comfortable. Take a deep breath. You are now standing in front of a mirror. You look in the mirror and you see yourself as old. You choose how old that is. You look at your hair, you look at your skin, you look at your clothes. And now you look at the place that you are in. And you picture that place, whether it's a home, an apartment, a nursing home, a hospital. And you picture the things that are in that room that are yours. You see the things that are present, and you see the things that now aren't part of your life that you miss. Picture yourself now walking in this older state, either over to a chair or to a bed, where you will get down and sit or lie. Watch how you move. As you sit or recline there, you are brought the face of the loved one that has just recently died. You determine who that loved one is. You feel the pain and the grief and the loneliness of that absence and how it affects you physically, emotionally, or spiritually. And then as you sit or lie there, you are reminded as you move of the chronic illness that you must cope with daily, hourly, and how that now affects your life. Whether it be a hearing loss, loss of sight, arthritis, or perhaps it's a terminal illness. There's a knock at the door, and a visitor arrives to see you. You choose who that is and whether you know them or not. Now we're going to let the conversation between the two of you unfold. What does the caller ask or say? how do you respond in the next conversation? And I'm going to give you 1 minute of silence to have that conversation in your mind. Now the visitor needs to leave. Listen to how he or she negotiates the leaving. You are alone again with your memories and feelings of that visit. Recognize how you feel and react to that visitor and conversation. And when you have felt those reactions, please open your eyes. When I did this for the first time, it was about 10, 11 years ago. And I had never envisioned myself old. So I came out of this with this huge lump in my throat. I had never envisioned myself with a chronic illness. I had never envisioned myself in a nursing home. And so it was like, oh. So for me, this was a moving experience. It may have been for you, it may not have been. But this is the place where we're gonna jump off and start discussing how you felt about what you went through. So I'd like you to share the kind of a light bulb aha experience that you had. I don't, for the sake of time, want the whole thing. I just want the, this is what I learned, this is what I felt. I want you to tell me, you know, how you felt about the age or the chronic illness or whatever, how you felt about the visitor, whether you liked them or whether you didn't like them, whether they made you angry, whether they fulfilled some needs, whether they just kind of came in, did their own thing. Give me your reactions to what you experienced, your light bulb reactions. Paul.
I loved the person that came to visit me, but when he left, I wished he hadn't come.
Why?
Too much emptiness afterwards. Too much a reminder of what I didn't have, what I lost in my life.
But you liked the visit.
I loved the visit. The visitor.
The visitor.
I don't know about the visit. Sure, I did.
You liked the visitor, but you didn't like the visit?
I liked the visitor, and I liked the visit. I didn't like, I wished he hadn't come, because what it brought, it reminded me too concretely of what I had lost.
So the next question is, would you want that visitor to come back?
Call on somebody else.
You think you can do that because you're my husband?
No, I don't know.
Okay, that's fine. And there is that ambivalence. You know, I love the visit, but now I hate the loneliness I feel when the person's gone. I think that's very valid. I think that's very valid. Did you say to that visitor, come back or thank you?
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that's really true. I mean, that thank you for coming, but now I feel so lonely. I mean, that's good. Thank you. That is good.
What else could you say?
The person that came to visit me wasn't somebody I knew on a deep level. It was more like it could have been a nurse that I was familiar with.
Okay.
Somebody that I was familiar in a surface relationship, kind of. So, and I liked the visit.
Was there something that you connected with? Did they say or do something that you particularly liked?
They let me talk, and yet they they had me go outside.
Oh.
They said, let's go outside, and it was in a way of not taking over and saying, it's time for you to go outside.
Uh-huh.
It was, why don't we go outside and...
an invitation.
Yeah. So all I would have to do was say, okay, that sounds nice, instead of me having to make a decision.
Uh-huh.
And
so you like the fact that they kind of went an extra mile and took you someplace that otherwise you couldn't have gotten? And
right. They got me out of my...
out of that room that was...
That, yeah, okay. Exactly. The room that I just kept looking at the four walls and the things that were reminding me of my loss. So it, because they weren't somebody that I was deeply... familiar with, I was able to stay in out of that area of sadness.
Okay, good. So, and you like the visit?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Marian.
I went through my mother's death. I was at her bedside. I was very much alone. My family was here in Washington. I was down in Florida. There was no one there but me, and she was in the nursing home, and she was dying. And the visitor who came in was Christ, because I had no one. I had no one at all. That's the only friend I had. And he came in, and he spoke to me, giving me some comforting words, and I asked him if he would take her soul. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really sure whether my mother was a very strong-minded woman. And she just didn't think that God really gave her a rap in life. And I just asked that he forgive her and that he takes her. And I knew that she was going to go, and I knew that he was going to leave me, and she was going to leave me also. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of a double thing. And he left, he gave me some comforting words, and he left just as silently as he came. And I sat there, and my mother just quit breathing.
Kind of the ultimate visitor, isn't it?
Yes, it is the ultimate visitor. Yeah.
We don't have to ask if that was a good visit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had my sister, my niece visit me, because I just got a letter from her, so she was on my mind, and she tried to tell me that comfort me, but she couldn't understand. She's too young. So even though her comfort was very sincere and I loved her,
she couldn't understand what you were going through.
No.
As this older, lonely, grieving person.
She couldn't understand that level of loss.
Yeah.
But so she tried to say, you know, you still have us, I still love you. And so I was comforted by that.
The fact that she could love you.
Yeah.
But then she couldn't.
But then I said, I didn't say, well, that's no good, but I thought to myself, right, well, I'm glad, but it's not the same, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also thought about when she had to go, I didn't want her to feel that she had to come back. So I didn't want to say, you know, when will you be back?
Because you didn't want to put that responsibility on her, make her think that she had to. Very kind of you.
With her family, you know.
And don't you think there are a lot of older people that don't that do that? You know, they have their lives. How many times have you heard people say, "Well, they have their lives," mm-hmm. and yet obviously her visit made a whole lot of hit you really in the heart because of the fact that I love you. She said, even though she probably didn't ask you, did she ask you to tell you about herself? I mean, you did she ask you to tell stories about yourself or anything?
No, I wanted to hear about her.
Oh, you wanted to hear about her life.
Children and that kind of thing.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Just before we close our eyes, I saw Gertrude, and so I couldn't see myself, and what I saw in the mirror was Gertrude. I'm sorry, Gertrude. And I couldn't see myself. But then I saw Gertrude standing there, and you're in a little pink sweater or something. And then I thought about and I don't know if this is true, but I thought about Gertrude's loss, because I knew her husband used to play the organ here. And so then I was thinking about that, thinking about your husband.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was very nice. But I couldn't see myself.
Interesting that you couldn't see yourself.
I couldn't get to myself. I saw Gertrude and I thought, you know, what am I? Well, I don't have white hair, or I probably won't, and I couldn't get to myself.
That is an interesting thing, that you can't see yourself old. I like to be Gertrude.
When you're there, you can see yourself.
Iona.
Well, I was like you. I just couldn't picture myself old. And then I thought, who in the world would I want to come and visit me? And then I thought about my little granddaughter. When she comes, old grandma, you know, and she's eyes just full of love and... you know, and you want him to come back again. And then I thought of my grandson in Minneapolis, and through separation, he lives with his father, and so I don't get to see them very often. And a couple of years ago, there was a knock on the door, and I hollered, come in, and he said, hi, Grandma. And that visit was, for me, a grandma, it was wonderful, because we walked through the house because I was going to sell my home, and he was telling me all what he remembered about it, and it was just the most wonderful visit.
One of those precious moments in life that you'll reflect on.
And, you know, a lot of times now, like I visit a gal in the nursing home, and I come in and I say, restore the Tilly dog. And then she comes back with some Swedish sentence, you know. And then we start talking, and she'll tell me about her past. And whenever she has, her daughter lives in Minneapolis and just comes on weekend. So I go and visit her just about every afternoon. She just waits for me to come, because we talk.
You talk and you share stories and feelings. Good. Getting, sharing those feelings, having the tradition of you start out in the little Swedish sentence there.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. How many of you had somebody you didn't like? Is there anybody that you didn't like, the visitor?
Oh, no, I think...
Could you mind telling me about it? Either one
my,
of you?
My stepsister came to visit me. Her and I really don't get along. But she's always... I had gone through the loss of my mother. My mother and I are as close... as anybody can be, and she came to visit me, and she's all into sports and keeps herself, you know, physically fit, and she's just the perfect woman, and here I'm all old and decrepit and, you know, dying from my asthma, and I really can't do anything. And she's like, why are you just sitting there sulking and feeling sorry for yourself? Get out and do something. And it was nice that she came to see me, but I was just, go away.
Yeah. You know? It was worse than not having her come at all, right?
Yeah,
because she just pushed all your buttons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tried to fix it, tried to tell you how you could be lots better if you'd only do this.
She had all the answers for me.
Had all the answers.
Yeah.
The visit we dislike the most is when somebody tries to give us all the answers and comes in kind of with their agenda and with their answers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Do you mind telling us about yours?
Yeah, mine was kind of a fictitious church person that
good.
Came in wanting to do good. And
good!
Very exuberant, you know, and I was just kind of wanting to take a nap. I was in my home, in my recliner, still with a yard and stuff, so... Just to not have her yammer in my head so much, I sent her outside with scissors to get flowers and kind of do the kibble bowl and pet the kitties and bring one in, and then we could start having a conversation. Kind of prepare.
What was the one thing you didn't like initially about this lady?
Oh, her energy and do-goodness and just sit down and relax, kind of. Okay. So she was too exuberant.
Okay. So. As opposed to you, who are sitting in the recliner, and, you know, she's trying to fill the space with her energy
chatter.
And her chatter.
Okay.
What would you have had her do?
Maybe be a little bit more low-key and just tone it down a bit and ask how I'm doing, instead of just bluey kind of hitting like a hurricane.
Yeah.
So, and then stories.
I'm glad we had some negative stories, because that really does help. Anybody else? Any other light bulb experience that you want to share?
I envisioned a wonderful friend visiting me. We had a wonderful time because she talked to me about things and I got to talk to her about her family and things that were going on. She has a lot of grandchildren, and so I could catch up on that. And she's a church member, so I could find out about other church members. And I was very happy she came to see me. She gave me some of her time.
Good. So it was a give and take. She didn't chatter all the time. It was a give and take. Lovely. Nice balance in your visit. How did your visitors leave? I said, one of the things I said is, how did the person negotiate their leaving? They just get up and say, well, it's time for me to go. Did they do it nicely? Did they, you know?
Mine vanished through the door.
But yours is a little unusual. Yeah. How else did they sell them leave?
I didn't think about it, but she probably said, well, I have to do something else, you know, at this time, so, you know, I can't stay any longer, but I'll come and see you again.
Okay. Did some of your, how many of you had a visitor that touched you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But some of you didn't have a visitor who touched you. Okay. How did you feel, those of you who had someone who touched you, how did you feel when that person touched you? And did they shake your hand, hug you, put your hand on their shoulder? What did they do? And how did you react?
Oh, I loved it.
You loved it. Anybody else? Anyway, who didn't like the touch? The person was inappropriate. Okay, well, we won't go there. Anything else anybody wants to share about this visit? Okay.
Mine brought me back in, and I could walk, but I had some kind of anemia, so I was really slow. So when we went outside, we went in the wheelchair. So he brought me back and helped me back onto the bed where I was sitting originally and said, I got a goodbye. And so then it instantly brought me back into a depression. So it was all good, but then all of a sudden it was like,
So kind of like what Paul said, like, now they're gone and now I'm feeling lonely.
Yeah, now I can go back to my horrid thoughts again.
Yeah, in this room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. This definitely helps. Now we're going to talk about, and we'll use maybe some of these experiences as we go along, kind of the things people need. I know you can't all read this, and so I'm going to give you kind of a synopsis of what this is. This is obviously Ann Landers. A woman is writing in who says that when she was 10 years old, her mother died of cancer, and not long after, 2 weeks after the funeral, her father told her, dry your tears, I don't want to see you crying anymore, I want you to smile, or you're going to find someplace else to live. She goes on to the bottom and says, I didn't need the standard cliches. I did need someone to talk to, cry with, and even scream at. Most of all, I needed someone to hold me and to tell me that everything was going to be better. After all, aren't these the basic needs of all hurting people? And at the bottom, suppressed grief is like a time bomb. If it goes underground, and it will explode later, causing a great deal of damage. I believe that probably 65 to 70% of the people who walk through the doors of a place where they get mental health care are people who are working on an unresolved grief. If you don't talk about grief, it comes up someplace else. This woman was working on this a long time when she was 10 years old. Now what is she, 37 years ago it happened, so whether it turns into alcoholism, it turns into other types of chronic mental illnesses. Unresolved grief is an unbelievable thing that comes back to haunt us afterwards. You can turn the lights back on. Actually, I have to be able to see my notes here. again, this person needs the hugs, needs the listening, needs somebody to talk with, cry with, scream at. That's when we have to be comfortable with the uncomfortable, because some of those situations aren't comfortable. And if this person is screaming about how angry they are at God, can we sit there and listen to that? They have to get that out. It has to be heard by somebody. Listeners say, but when we walk into a situation, we say, but, you know, I want to do something. And I say to you, the listener has to be the passive person. We don't come in there to fix it, to give them solutions. But you are active in a passive way. Listening actively. If you're looking someone in the eye and you're nodding as they tell their story and you're handing them a tissue if they're crying and you're formulating a question that helps them go on to tell the story, and if you're parroting back what they have said to you, oh, that happened? Oh my gosh, that must have been so painful. Oh, I can see how painful, you know, the story is. So, like, just those things that keep them telling the story is that active portion of listening. The last thing they want is advice. You don't have to turn it off. I'm going to read all these to you anyway. I'll read this to you off of here, because I don't think you can see it. For better or worse, my favorite cartoon. April's really wearing me out these days, Connie. She wants to be more mobile so badly. All she wants to do is hang on my hands and walk. She's irritable. If I leave her, she screams. She hardly naps at all. I can't seem to get anything done. Here's the response. You just need to be firm, Elle. Tell her that you've got things to do then. Put her in her playpen and go, and she'll get the idea. Her mind says, spoken like a friend who doesn't have a baby. Elle did not want advice from her friend. She just wanted to be able to tell somebody how her day was going and how difficult it was that day to be a mom.
Right.
Didn't want advice. Didn't want any advice at all. I have a befriender by the name of John who made a call. All of our befrienders, as I said, take this 28 weeks of training. They go up on the floors, make calls for about an hour and a half, come down, write up their visits, and then debrief with all of us chaplains. You have to debrief before you leave the hospital. So you don't carry these stories home with you, which can be sometimes very oppressive, and so that we chaplains can get referrals to who we want to go back and see. Well, John came down, and he said, I had an amazing visit today. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he said, well, I went into this room, and this man had a very heavy, heavy accent. And he said, in the beginning of the conversation, I got his name and kind of why he was here at the hospital and what he did for a living. And then he just took off, and talking as fast as he could in this very heavy accent, he talked for 25 minutes. He said, every once in a while I could get a word here or a word there, but he was deep into his story. And all of a sudden, after 25 minutes, he slowed down and he said, and I quote, it's so nice to have a friend. Please come back, and thank you for listening. And John said, so I got up and knew I was being dismissed and shook the man's hand and walked out. And I said, John, you don't know what he was talking about, do you? And he said, no. And I said, how'd you keep him going? He said, I looked him right in the eye, and I just kept every once in a while nodding. And he said, and I'd smile at him. I said, John, does it make any difference at all that you don't have a clue what he said? He looked at me and said, no. No, it doesn't. Because in the telling of the stories is the healing. John didn't need to know those facts, but that fella sure needed to tell what was going on in his life, and obviously loved the visit by his response. This cartoon sort of exemplifies that. Being a good listener is a gift. Being a good pretend listener is a real gift. Wow, really, boy. Oh, no, really, huh? What? I love that. That's exactly what John did that day. So what we give folks is the presence. And I'm just going to take a couple quotes from this. Be near, but don't hover. Don't just do something, stand there. Don't fill silence with talk. I have a friend who talks constantly. If I have a problem, I have to say to her, Kathleen, listen, I need you to hear this, and I need this space in time. Otherwise, I can't get it from her.
Because she fills up space with talking. Don't give answers to questions that have no answers.
Right, that's the questions that, you know.
And that's in grief, right? Yeah. Why did this happen? Well, don't tell them why their loved one died. I mean, we don't know.
Who knows?
Well, yeah, right? We don't want answers to those questions that have no answers. Let your heart do the talking, not your head, some of those others. But mostly just what is present. We'll leave that up there for you.
I'll get one.
That's fine. That's fine. So it's presence. It's that I'm here for you presence that's important. I am going to have to take it down because I have to. Well.
Go ahead.
I got a Henry Nouwen one. You'll like this one too. Henry Nouwen, I believe, is one of the greatest teachers in how to be present to people. His book, Reaching Out, and Wounded Healer, which I didn't put on the board. I don't know if we had. I didn't order any books for this class. We got them? Wonderful. Two of the great books. This is a wonderful quote. How to be helpful. A friend who can be silenced with us in a moment of despair or confusion. Who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us the reality of our powerlessness, that is a friend who cares. And I, you know, look at all those words, silent, stay, tolerate, I mean, they're all the passive, the presence. And that just, quote, I think, is in Reaching Out.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
This, but, what do you say to people that say to you, why did God do this to me? What did I do to make God do this to me?
That's why did God do this to me? Somebody else want to answer that question? Why did God do this to me? And at the hospital, we have all sorts of people who say that. Iona.
What I knew, what I did, was that one of our elderly pastors was driving along and he sneezed and he hit a car. And so he was in the hospital. And so I got a big brown teddy bear and I went into him. And I said, I didn't say anything, but I said, this teddy bear is just like God. He's around, but probably you don't think he is. But you can throw this teddy bear, you can get angry at this teddy bear, but you can pick it up and love it again. And, I don't know what the results of that were, but he had that teddy bear.
Beautiful form of ministry. And you were there for him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I didn't know, because he was a pastor, and I didn't know what to say, but I thought, teddy bears. So after that, sometimes I bought him a big one. They were expensive, but I just bring a little.
But he was the pastor after all.
Yeah, right. But I brought little teddy bears to one lady that was dying, and I brought this teddy bear. And
something
I said,
to hold
on
to.
I said, just feel how soft this is and think about it. Oh, it's just like God, he's here.
Correct.
But you don't feel him. You don't probably know he's here, but he's still here. Just like this teddy bear,
One of the ways that I handle that, and I would welcome anyone to share how they handle it, is to ask them a question. Do you really think God caused this? Most
they
of the time.
They think they caused it.
Or why did I
cause it? They usually think that they have done something bad.
Okay,
or
the other
because
side.
Because of how they lived or.
Why?
All that stuff is in the Old Testament about how people were punished and they believed that, God and.
What did I do to deserve this? That was,
And I know in my parish nursing program, we talked briefly about how the Old Testament did talk about that, and how the New Testament is hope, and that Jesus doesn't talk about people being punished. But that's real hard for me to get across.
And usually I go into and say, do you really believe that? And if they really do, most of the time, again, as a chaplain, they really don't want answers. But if they really do want answers, and we get to the point where they really want me to say something, then I do say, and I phrase it by, this is my own theology. And I'm telling you this as an individual, you know, as a Christian for sure, but also this is just how I cope with it, so that I don't say that this is how the world does it and this is how the Bible, you know, this is how I, and I say, you know, I think we are put in an imperfect world. And in this imperfect world, there are germs and there are diseases and there are drunk drivers and there are all sorts of things that are negative that we have to cope with as human beings. And in my family, we have breast cancer. And so God didn't give my ancestor breast cancer and it's gone all the way down. It's part of who I am. And if I have a friend who gets, whose child gets hit by a drunk driver, God didn't cause that child to get hit by a drunk driver and die. That person made a bad decision in drinking and then driving and then hitting that kid. So we live in a world where we have to cope with negative things. Some things, powers of evil, you know, the alcohol, what alcohol can do, people making bad decisions, diseases and germs that get transmitted. One of my agonies is working with AIDS patients who then someone says to me, well, of course they deserve that because that's a homosexual, isn't it? That's a virus, for heaven's sakes. You know, and we live in a world that has those things. So that's how I, if I'm shoved into a corner, I'd rather have them work out how they, what their theology is. But given it, I will. And
I'm not sure you're going to get to this, so I want to ask it, but how do you talk to people,
say that again?
How do you advise talking to people who have Alzheimer's or a certain degree of dementia and they're not making sense? And that's where I run into problems with, because I don't feel like we're really communicating. And couldn't counter that?
That's really hard. We talked a little bit about that last night. And the interesting thing about many people that have at least some degree of dementia or Alzheimer's, they can talk about the past. They can't tell you what they had for lunch, but they can tell you about their childhood. They can tell you about their early years. They can tell you about their early years of marriage. And if they still have those capabilities, that's what you talk about. Because they find such joy in it. Sometimes they don't even know that they're, you know, 87-year-old. In their own mind, they're 13 and they're skipping and they're playing, you know, they're fishing and anything that can get them to talk about anything. It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be present. Just get them talking. Because people like to talk about themselves and they love to reminisce. And they love to do life review. And as was pointed out in, I think it was Dan Erlander's session, that many times a person can, if they can't do anything else, they can say the Lord's Prayer because it's part of their making, or they can sing songs. You know, a person who's totally out of it in anything else, you start singing Jesus Love Me and they can go right in and sing it. You know, you start saying the Lord's Prayer or the 23rd Psalm and they can do it. But many times music will bring that out. And that's why I really believe in music therapy, because it can bring out. I had a patient who would not talk to me. He wouldn't talk to me about anything. I said to him one day, do you like big band music? He said, yeah, I love it. I mean, he was so grouchy. So I brought in a tape. I put in some big band music. His foot started tapping. His fingers started snapping. His body started moving. All of a sudden, he started talking to me about the big bands he used to travel in. But he wasn't going to talk before that. So all sorts of things can bring out, but it's kind of like trial and error with those sorts of folks, and that's hard ministry.
And sometimes with Alzheimer's, you do not so much communicate with words, but with action.
Exactly.
A touch, a walk, creating an environment.
Exactly.
Just feel safe.
Yeah.
We do a lot of walking. We do a lot of walking down our little hallway, or just sitting with them.
Rubbing their back.
Oh yeah, just the ministry of touch.
Hand.
Sometimes yeah. Words don't. You don't have to necessarily
exactly.
Have words.
Putting hand lotion on their hands, brushing their hair.
Yeah. Can I go back to her question just for a second?
Oh sure.
A lot of times, sometimes they need permission to be angry with God and to ask God questions. So a lot of times I'll say, "You're kind of angry at God, or you want to question God." And, you know, whatever they say, to give them permission to question God and assure them that they aren't going to go to hell if they get questioned God, or that they aren't, it's okay to be angry with God. And you help them through that. And sometimes, for some people, that's just a temporary state.
Oh, absolutely.
And they just, that's where they're at now. Today, I'm just really angry at God. And why did God do this? And you want to have a disagreement with God. You know, and you kind of...
And God is big enough to handle this.
Yeah.
Anger.
Yeah.
And don't feel guilty about being angry.
You can doubt God and still be okay. Yeah.
Can you go back and touch on having people work through their theology?
Having to
how
what?
How do you do that? Not imposing your theology, but going back and having them work on their theology.
What do you want me to
what
say?
What kind of question do you ask to get them to do that, to make them think that way?
Just a simple statement like, tell me more about that. Tell me how you feel about that. I mean, the broader the question, the better. Because we don't want to pigeonhole people with a question that's too narrow. So, you know, tell me how you feel about God. Or it sounds like you're feeling pretty angry at God right now, or you're feeling pretty trapped by this illness. Tell me, you know, I can't imagine how that feels, or I can't imagine what it's like to have this disease. I can't imagine what it's like to have lost this spouse. How does God fit into your life? Have you been? Is God a person that you gain strength from? God, someone that you gain strength from? Some people don't have a relationship. They just believe in a God, but they don't get any strength from God. They don't have any relationship, so they can't draw on that God for the strength and the support and the whatever. So I guess what you need to get to is how they, what kind of faith they have. I had an AIDS patient once who was the most, he was the unkindest, most unhospitable person I had ever met. No nurse wanted to go into that room. And so they sent the chaplain, of course. And they said, he's going to kick you out of his room. And what happened is I gave him permission to do that. I said, you know, I'm optional. You know, a lot of things here aren't optional, but I am, so you can kick me out anytime you want. Anytime I stick my nose in the room, you can say, go away, and I will. And so he said, sit down, because I gave him a choice. And when I left that day, I said, I'll be back, but you can tell me not to come. Well, he, in the process of dying, I had asked him about his faith, because for all practical purposes, it wouldn't look like he had any. And he was pretty mad at God that he didn't believe in. And as he was dying, there was this cross that I told you about on the end of his bed. And he said to me, Jeannie, I know who that man is. I mean, I don't even know if he knew the name, but he said, I know who that man is. And I said, tell me about that. And he said, I went to church as a little kid, so I know who he is. And I said, do you know what he did? And he goes, yeah, I know he died for me. And he said, I gained strength when I look at him. And I said, never forget that what he did on that cross, he did for you because he loved you. And you don't have to know anything else, but that he did that for you, and it's a gift. We had to kind of get down to where he was, which was way back there. I don't think I'm answering your question. So I guess the way to answer your question is to ask the questions and find out where they are and what they glean and how they connect and go from there. I guess what I'm saying is everybody is so different,
mm-hmm.
is that you have to kind of play it by ear. I don't know how to better answer that. Unless you can ask me the question in a different way. Mm-hmm. Ask me something else.
I'll think about it.
Okay.
It seems like you have to sort of ask their questions. Because they're the ones that you're trying to help figure mm-hmm. it out. It's not my question, what do I want to know about you?
Yeah.
But what do I think you want to know about yourself?
Mm-hmm. And use their words. Mm-hmm. And anything that a person puts out there is okay to ask about. If they say, I'm dying, or I'm lonely, or I'm angry, they have put it on the table, and so you can discuss it. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be putting stuff out there that they don't want to discuss. But what they put out there, that's okay to talk about. Anything else before I turn this on?
Okay. This has never meant a great deal to me. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Didn't say much to me. Then somebody gave me the real Greek translation of this, and I absolutely love it. Fortunate are those who go through deep emotional hurt, for they shall have a called person alongside. Which, I don't read it, but I was told that this is the definition. Deep emotional hurt says a whole lot more than mourn. When we think of mourning, we think of someone has had to die. And so that became very, very closed. But now with this new translation, those who have a deep emotional hurt. What I love about the next piece is, for they shall have. That's a promise. I don't know how some of you, but I like to go through sometimes the Bible and kind of read those promises that I'm given. And that's a promise, for they shall have. And the next word, a called person. A called person. You're going to have a called person come alongside you to help you go through stuff. We're going to talk about who's called in a minute. And then come along. Now, it's my belief that we are all called people by virtue of our baptism. When we were baptized, we were called and ordained into ministry. And so we can't just leave this to the clergy. Sometimes that'd be a lot easier. Oh, that the clergy can do that. No. How many of you in your church that says, in our church, for example, it says pastors, and it lists the pastors, and it says staff, and then it lists the staff, and then it says ministers, and it says dash, the people of St. Paul Lutheran Church. You know, it'd be a lot easier not to have to consider ourselves ministers, but I think that's what we're called to do. And then to walk alongside. Oh, I love that statement. Because whether somebody is angry, which we talked about, you walk alongside him. You don't push him through like that lady in the beginning of the story trying to push this woman through widowhood. You let you go with them. If they're angry, you let them talk about their anger. If they're crying, you let them cry. For heaven's sakes, I hate that line, you shouldn't cry. Oh, thank goodness people don't use that as much anymore. We hand them a Kleenex, we cry with them, for heaven's sakes. We walk alongside them. If they're going through joy, maybe this is the first time they've gone out and had their hair cut and gone out for lunch and they're finally laughing. I mean, the worst thing you'd want to say is, well, you're laughing an awful lot to have been a widow only 2 weeks. I mean, no. Wherever they are is where we walk alongside of them. Going with them, taking their hand, whatever it takes to be that companion alongside. Ooh, we got 4 minutes left, so we're going to have to pick and choose here. Have to tell you this. One of my friends who is taking chaplaincy training, she walked up to the first day of she was a student chaplain, she walked up to a 40-year veteran chaplain, and she said, this is my first day. What's the most important thing that you want to tell me as I enter in to this calling? And he, without a hesitation, said, remember the experiences you are called into are holy ground. Remember the experiences you are called into are holy ground. Now, you're going to say, well, that's a chaplain in a hospital. That's pretty holy ground. And I'm going to say, all of the experiences that we are called into, whether it's a conversation here at Holden, you know, on the bench, outside, or whether it's a friend who just told you they're getting a divorce, or whether it's a little kid who just told you that they got picked last in the line for volleyball, or whatever it is, that time and that space and that interaction and connection is holy ground, because that person is sharing with you intimately about their hurts, their pain, their isolation, loneliness, whatever. And that connection of love and acceptance and somebody hearing how I feel on the inside is sacred ground, which is the other thing we want to jump to, which is we don't go share that with somebody. That was given to us as a gift, and that's why we don't tell somebody else and end up gossiping about it.
we hold that as a gift that was given just to us. I'm going to have to conclude because I think I have a minute left. What am I going to take out? Well, the fact that you have come to this particular class, you know, I say God bless you. Because you're saying that you wanted to know more about how to minister, how to care, how to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. And it's my hope that you can just take something away from this and be blessed in your ministry of listening and caring and connecting and being in sacred space and holding the stories that are shared with you tenderly and as holy. So I will stay around. Thank you for coming, and I couldn't get everything in, but I can stay as long as anyone wants to share and interact or ask questions. So again, thank you.